Hello, this is Jay Sperling Reich. I wanted to preface this week's episode by letting you know that when we recorded, Michael Giltz, one of our regular co-hosts, was traveling on holiday. The only place he could find an internet connection to participate in this week's episode was in a cafe that was quite noisy. That should explain some of the sounds you hear in the background whenever Michael is speaking during the episode. We hope you'll bear with us and enjoy this week's episode. Thank you. For the week of December 27th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 35, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at Cranky's Cafe in Long Island City, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing at Cranky's Cafe?
It's the only place I could find Wi-Fi.
In all of New York City, that's the only place you could find Wi-Fi?
Based on where I was at the moment.
Well, I think it's very appropriate that you are at Cranky's Cafe.
Because I'm cranky?
I never said that. You did.
That was my joke. I'm like, how appropriate. You're Cranky's. I love that.
I did steal that joke from you from prep. But I have to say that, do you remember when we were discussing in one of our post-show moments whether we should do a show on December 28th or not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I go back and say no?
Yeah, I know, right?
It's the most exciting week of the year for entertainment news.
Well, then that'll be a really fast show.
That's true. Michael, I know you're joking because most entertainment journalists are actually vacationing right now.
I'm not joking. It's one of the most exciting events of the decade.
Why is
that? As far as movies are concerned.
Ah, okay. Well, that's very true. So you must be talking about the box office.
Exactly. I like a lot of people. I went to the movies this weekend with my family. My mom was astonished and said it was a sin that people go to a movie on Christmas Day. But apparently a lot of people were sinning because it was a gigantic weekend at the box office.
I was sinning.
Sperling, did you sin?
I sinned, but not on Christmas. And I'm sorry, I was just trying to get the mental image of Karen Woodward sinning. I'm sorry. Out of my mind. I'm sorry.
That just added 20 minutes.
I wish, Sperling. No, I was movie sinning.
Okay. Well, anyway, it was the biggest single day gross on Christmas Day of all time for Sherlock Holmes. It was the biggest Christmas weekend of all time. And it was the best weekend period of all time at the Hollywood box office. It was a massive, massive weekend. Three movies grossed over $50 million. Everybody, practically everybody, was a winner. The number one movie at the box office was Sperling's favorite film, Avatar, with $75 million. It's already at over $200 million in the U.S., over $600 million worldwide, proving once and for all that when it comes to movies about giant blue men, Sperling knows a lot more than I do.
And so does James Cameron, who directed that film.
And so does James Cameron. The number two movie was Sherlock Holmes, which I inexplicably enjoyed, even though it has very little to do with Sherlock Holmes. The Robert Downey Jr. film opened to $65 million. Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Squeakquel, grossed $50 million. I saw that as well. And one box office person said that calling it The Squeakquel probably added at least $10 to $20 million to the box office. And frankly, I'm inclined to agree. Meryl Streep's It's Complicated opened at $22 million. Definite counter-programming. Up in the Air expanded modestly to $11 million. It's still waiting to catch fire despite, you know, massive critical acclaim. The Blind Side grossed another $11 million. That's another $184 million about to blast past $200 million. Princess and the Frog, I think, really is a disappointment. They made $8.6 million. It's at $63 million, and it's just not doing that well. And if there's a flop for the weekend, it was Nine, the musical starring Daniel Day-Lewis. It grossed only $5.5 million. That's bad news for the Weinstein brothers. Did you hear about The Morgans is fading fast with $5 million? Invictus is doing very, very modest business, $23 million total. Twilight Saga is at $280 million, and A Christmas Carol is at $135 million, and that's almost completely done, of course. Nobody's going to go after New Year's to see A Christmas Carol. But the weekend as a total grossed $278 million. It's the biggest weekend of all time. Beat July 2008 when The Dark Knight helped set a record. Avatar had the second biggest weekend for any movie on record, second only to The Dark Knight. And Alvin made $36 million overseas. It's just a massive, massive weekend at the movies. Everybody went to the movies.
I was really interested that Avatar grossed $145 million overseas, which made Fox International, it gave them an industry record. They made over $2 billion this year. It's the first time ever that a studio has earned over $2 billion.
I have to say, I'm a little surprised. I mean, when I saw the movie, I started to get worried and thought, uh-oh, I don't know if this is going to work. I can't believe the good word of mouth it's getting. Sproul, you're obviously right about how audiences would react to this movie. I was not wowed at all. I didn't find the special effects particularly thrilling. I found it technically interesting what they accomplished and the way they made it, but I'm not quite sure what audiences are reacting to. I mean, I didn't love Titanic, but I know why it was a massive hit. I didn't love Transformers, but I know why it made what it made. I really thought Avatar would get bad word of mouth, and it's not at all. It's getting tremendously good.
The fanboys love it. You know, I said last week that all my little nerd boy friends are seeing it, you know, twice, three times. They love it.
Can you get one of your little nerd boy friends to take you to see Avatar? I'm just wondering.
I don't know. I'll work on that.
I'm still trying to get the sinning picture out of my mind.
But it appeals to the person who doesn't necessarily need to have a story in their movie. Because all my nerd boys are telling me, oh, yeah, no, there's no story, and the dialogue sucks, and the acting's only adequate, but the special effects are so cool. That's why they're seeing them.
Well, and I was at a restaurant over the weekend, and we just got to talking to the people sitting next to us, and sure enough, they had just come from seeing Avatar. It was one of, I think, three movies they saw this year. And that's the kind of movie it is. It's the kind of movie that people who don't ordinarily go to see movies will actually get out and go see in the theater.
It's an event.
That's right. It's an event. It's astonishing that it dropped only 2.6%. That's remarkable.
Well, I don't think it's completely remarkable. I mean, it opened the weekend before a holiday. It opened the weekend before Christmas. And when you open a movie the weekend before Thanksgiving or Christmas or the weekend before July 4th, you can have a bump up or, you know, even grow business the following weekend. But obviously, it opened so big that it is still impressive. And on the other hand, there was that storm, so there was probably some pent-up demand. So if it had opened even bigger the weekend before, maybe it wouldn't have stayed so tight. But, you know, there's no way to paint it as anything other than tremendously successful.
That's right. On the east coast of the United States, there was a storm the weekend that Avatar opened, and the snowstorm kept a lot of people away from theaters, and so it was remarkable that it even made $77 million in its North American debut.
Well, I saw four movies at the box office this weekend. I saw Sherlock Holmes, Alvin and the Chipmunks, It's Complicated, and five, The Blind Side, and Nine. So what movies did you see this weekend, Karen?
Well, first of all, I want to know, how was The Blind Side? Because I did not see that.
Did I say The Blind Side? Sherlock Holmes, Alvin and the Chipmunks, It's Complicated, Up in the Air, and Nine.
Well, I saw It's Complicated because I spent Christmas with my mom and my sister, and it was, you know, chick flick and something we could all agree on. I thought it was awful. It's a terrible movie. But
even with Meryl Streep in it?
Oh, she's really great in it. But there's so much about it that's just it's unbelievable. I mean, first of all, spoiler alert, you don't really want them to get back together because Alec Baldwin's such a jerk. And the kids are like, it's terrible acting and the writing is awful. And it just, the whole thing made me hungry because she owns a bakery. And it's just, it's awful. It's awful.
Michael, what did you think of It's Complicated? Was it complicated or easy for you?
No, it wasn't complicated at all. There were some bizarre touches, like Meryl Streep has this gorgeous home. All her kids have moved out. She's got a gigantic kitchen, and all she does is dream about building an addition so she can have an even bigger kitchen.
Yeah, how could she possibly afford that?
Well, she's got her own business, and presumably
she probably gets alimony, but
I have to say, I did enjoy Meryl Streep. She was movie star mode, you know.
Gosh,
definitely
gorgeous.
She's enjoying herself. She looked great. She was sexy and fun. Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin are fun. They're much better than the script.
And you also saw Nine, which everybody's saying is a flop. It only opened in 1,400 theaters. It made
plenty of theaters. 1,400 theaters. You can make $800 million on 1,400 theaters. That's plenty of theaters.
Well, didn't
that's,
do too
that's
well.
That's not a limited release, for heaven's sake.
No, it's not. Did you like the film?
No. They shoot every scene. Every musical number is interrupted by a flashback or an actual scene, or it's in someone's imagination. So you never get a single musical number from beginning to end. So that has no emotional impact. It's like, you know, he did a similar trick in Chicago where everything was happening in her head. And that was the explanation for why people broke into song. And in this movie, every musical number is a memory or an idea of Daniel Day-Lewis or some other character's internal thoughts. But we never get a number from beginning to end. So it just doesn't work. You've got to give us the whole number. Let us sink into it and build up some, you know, as soon as they start to build up some steam, they cut away to some other imagery or something else that's going on, like dialogue. It's very frustrating.
I think it's very funny that you're talking about a musical with music in the background.
I always hear music.
You carry your own music behind your own musical accompaniment.
Always in his head.
And now we can hear it. Now, you said you saw Alvin and the Chipmunks. Did you like the film?
No, I think it was a little modestly better than the original, actually. But that's not saying much. And Jason Lee was disappointingly not in it. I guess he didn't want to be in it. He just didn't want the paycheck. He has literally like two or three scenes at the beginning and the end of the film. So I like him a lot. So that was a bummer. But they were convincing. And the Chipettes sang the Beyonce song. And my nephew, Justin, when asked what he would give the movie on a scale of 1 to 10, said, a 10. It was a really good movie.
Well, you saw Sherlock Holmes, as did I. I thought it was beautifully shot with wonderful production design, and the fact that I'm talking about both the cinematography and the production design should tell you what I thought of the movie. Michael, you said you liked it.
I kind of enjoyed it. I thought Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. were both really good for their roles, and they took a lot of liberties, and I shouldn't have liked it, and the mystery was sort of dumb, and there was lots of action scenes that were stupid, but somehow they sort of had the right spirit, the two guys, and I found myself enjoying it, and I'm sort of a Sherlock Holmes purist, so I really came in thinking I would hate it, and so I was surprised that I didn't hate it.
How was Rachel McAdams in it?
She was all right. She plays, you know, the one woman that got the best of Sherlock Holmes, and so they have this tempestuous sort of romantic thing going on when he's not hitting on Jude Law. They definitely have fun
Really?
They definitely have fun at hinting at Holmes' sort of, you know, modest little jealousy about Jude Law moving, you know, getting engaged and moving out of their pad. I mean, he steals his clothes. He wears his clothes all the time. I mean, they have fun. But Billy Wilder got there first, you know, with The Private Lives of Sherlock Holmes. So that's not new ground. I'm sure we'll be seeing a sequel. It's all set up for, you know, Holmes and Moriarty. So we'll get a sequel. And I've heard rumors that Brad Pitt will play Moriarty. But, you know, we'll see. But, you know, Robert Downey Jr., it's a great moment for him. You know, he was down into nothing. Now he's got Iron Man 2. He's got Sherlock Holmes. I mean, he's on top of the world.
Hold on. I'm just enjoying the music.
Yeah.
I think that's Miles Davis.
Oh, he turned it off.
Oh, brother. Well, it was the biggest weekend, as Michael stated, even when counting for inflation. That's what I find remarkable, is that, yes, it beat out July 2008, but it wasn't just the more expensive 3D movie tickets for Avatar that put it over the top. Even with inflation accounted for, it solidly beat out the opening weekend of The Dark Knight in July of 2008.
Well, that's only a year ago, but I also saw a figure that said it's the highest number of tickets sold since they've been able to keep accurate records in 1985. So in the last 25 years, they sold more tickets this weekend than any other weekend.
Yes, our friend Paul DeGarabedian over at Hollywood.com came up with that figure. It's definitely a weekend to remember, at least for the box office. It will not be a week to remember as far as entertainment news goes. There wasn't much of it. And rather than get a whole bunch of guests on to talk about the news this week, I figured we'd just leave it at Karen, myself, and Michael Gilton, and the wait staff over at Cranky Cafe. I love the way he unmutes himself just to, like, laugh.
Just to laugh. I love, too, that we are not doing our best of the year things, because that always is really kind of stressing me out.
Well, because you always forget something.
I always forget something, yeah.
Well, maybe we should actually predict what 2010 will bring, although we'll do that a little later on in the show. I know, Karen, you wanted to talk about this interview of Manola Dargis, the film critic for the New York Times. You kind of mentioned last week that Kathryn Bigelow may or may not get an Academy Award nod.
And whether she would get dinged simply because she was a woman.
Right, and she's a female director, for those of you who are living under a rock. She directed
In space?
Yes, she directed The Hurt Locker. And you were saying that some people you were talking to thought she might not even get nominated for that film, even though it looks like a shoo-in for a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, it does. And between that and talking with my mom about what movies she goes to see, it really got me thinking and reading pieces about the dearth of women directors and whether women can open a movie and whether they make movies for women anymore. Because my mom said, you know, that she would go to the movies more often, but they just don't make movies that she wants to see. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But, you know, they used to make really good movies for women, and I just don't see that as much anymore. I don't think there were really that many good movies for women this year. I mean,
This is the year of the woman. Blindside and The Proposal and Julie and Julia and I mean
but
I could
those
go on and
aren't good
on.
movies, and they aren't dramas, and they aren't movies to be taken seriously.
Well, if you look at the top of the charts, the top grossing movies are all comic book movies, and I suppose those are guy movies in a way, but they're certainly not serious good movies for men either. Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen and Avatar and all, you know, regardless of what Sperling thought of it, you know, these are not good movies, they're just blockbusters. So there aren't a ton of, you know, thoughtful, intelligent films for men either. I mean, there's Invictus, I suppose, for the men, and Amelia with Hilary Swank for the women, but it's pretty dearthy for anybody.
And there's The Young Victoria for women, and there's Bright
Oh, well,
Star for women.
that's a tiny, tiny film. I think we're talking about Hollywood movies. You know, we're not talking about
No, I'm
independent
talking
foreign.
about any, because I think that there's a dearth in studio movies and in independent movies.
Well, Manola Dargis points out that there have been recent hits like The Devil Wears Prada, Sex and the City, and Mamma Mia have helped put a dent in the thinking that there are no movies for women. She says it will take more than millions of teenage girls and their moms squealing in delight at sparkly vampires and hair beasties with swollen deltoids before the real change will come to American movie screens.
And then she goes on to say that women need to develop their own muscles,
That's right.
and I agree with that. But then she goes on to say only three women have been nominated as directors by the Academy in 81 years.
Lena Wertmüller for Seven Beauties in 1976, Jane Campion for The Piano in 1993, and Sofia Coppola for Lost in Translation in 2003. Of course, none of them won.
And then she says, you know, that the closer you look at the list of female filmmakers from this year, and the more you separate the breathless hype about the better-known femme-driven picks, the worse the numbers get. Of the almost 600 new movies that will be reviewed by the New York Times by the end of 2009, about 60 were directed by women, or 10%. Only a handful of female directors picked up their paychecks from one of the six major Hollywood studios. So it's like the studios aren't hiring them either.
I mean, again, in Hollywood history, women dominated screenwriting. Women starred in tons of films all the time. And any studio that's not smart enough to use women as writers and directors and stars and build movies around them so that you can appeal to 51% of the population is stupid. And they're missing out on a huge audience. And every time they have a hit with Mamma Mia and Sex and the City and The Proposal and The Blind Side, they go, oh my gosh, look at that. You know, the stars will flock to any director who can get a movie made. So if women were making movies, they wouldn't care whether it's a man or a woman, as long as there's a green light.
Well, and Paul Daguerre-Bedian of Hollywood.com, who we spoke with last week, says women like going out in groups to watch women interacting in groups, and they are very loyal. If they discover something they like, they tell their friends about it. Women were social networking way before Facebook, and I guess, you know, certainly Oprah has proven that to be true.
Oh, I agree with that. I agree with that quote, and it's funny because Manola Dargis gave an interview to Jezebel.com where the writer for Jezebel showed her the quote and said, "Well, what do you think about this?" And Manola Dargis said, "You know, he's an a-hole," and that Derek Gabedian, whose name I always butcher, that he's an a-hole, and how dare he say that like all women care about is shopping? And my immediate reaction was, "Yeah, you go, girl." And then I read the quote and I'm like, "That's not what he's saying. He's saying that women do like to watch movies about groups of women, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. All those movies make money, so why are we not seeing more of those?"
Because everybody at the studio is a male. But there should be more gay men, because at least they would be smart enough to know you should make movies for women, just like Hollywood did for the first 50 years of its history.
Right, exactly. And plus, so many of women's pictures are cheap to make.
Exactly.
Because we don't require a lot of special effects. We just want to see groups of friends hanging out together, and we want a good love story. Boom, that's all we need.
It's not entirely true that all the heads of studios are men, because Amy Pascal runs Columbia Pictures and Sony, so she's a woman and she's been a very powerful executive in Hollywood for years.
And by the way, I'm also not saying that women don't enjoy, you know, Spider-Man just as much as a guy does, because I see all those movies too, you know, but it saddens me that, and Amy Pascal is equally guilty of it, that they make movies that only cater to 14-year-old boys.
I think that's less true. And if you look at the list of movies, you'll see there's a fair amount of hits that are for women and men and for just women. But there's no reason why there should be less than 10% of women as directors. That's just ridiculous. And they're stupid if they don't have a good mix of films. Every studio should have their women's films and their men's films and their blockbusters and their romantic comedies. And if you don't, you're dumb.
Here's something else that scares me, to take it from a completely different side, is that I think it was in the Washington Post, the writer interviewed Rod Lurie, who was male, and he did like The Contender and somebody else helped me.
Yeah, he does lots of women-oriented.
He does lots of women-oriented movies, and he's one of the producers for that TV show called Commander in Chief, which had Geena Davis as the president. And he said that their research showed that men were fine with a woman president. It was the women who were not. And that just scared me, because that made me realize that women have a long way to go in terms of empowering ourselves.
Well, only time will tell whether Kathryn Bigelow gets her proposed or potential nomination for an Academy Award for Best Director for The Hurt Locker, or if she does get nominated, whether she'll win it. The Los Angeles Times is doing their own bit of future prediction. They have a piece written by Joe Flint over the weekend called Get Ready for a Turbulent 2010 in Media, and this was a very fun article if you are following entertainment or media, in my opinion.
I loved this.
The first thing he says is that content is king, and that it became abundantly clear that it's more valuable to own what goes on the screen than the screen itself. I don't know when it was ever more valuable to own the screen.
Oh, I think that was probably when people decided that they needed to get, you know, their home screening systems and that, you know, bigger is better.
Well, also, I guess when Sony, a television manufacturer, an electronics manufacturer, came in and bought, you know, what was then Columbia TriStar Pictures.
That too.
He points out here that the Travel Channel sold for almost $1 billion and that Nickelodeon paid more than $50 million for the rights to some old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The one thing he points out is something we all know, that media companies have to figure out a way to monetize this content specifically on the internet, where most of it is given away for free.
Well, here is one of the few people who believes in what, Michael, I think you agree with me, that things should not be free on the internet. I mean, free to a certain degree, but not everything should be free in its entirety.
Right, you can't expect people to spend $2 million on a sitcom and you get to watch it for free without watching any ads. It's just not reasonable.
Yeah, and he's one of the first, it's one of the first times I've ever read something where somebody actually said that.
Right, and he's also pointing out that basically the way we consume media is changing. Joe Flint writes, odds are most of you will read our 2011 predictions on a computer, smartphone, e-reader, or tablet. How we'll get you to pay for it is another question.
Yeah.
His first prediction is not necessarily a difficult one. He says Jay Leno will be gone from prime time.
Yay!
Conan O'Brien has yet to show that he can fill Leno's seat, but bumping off O'Brien will be incredibly expensive for NBC. They will have to pay his contract out at $40 million, which Joe Flint is saying might be the cheaper option.
Huh. No way. No way are they going to bump out Conan O'Brien to put Jay Leno back in The Tonight Show.
No, they wouldn't do that.
They wouldn't do that. And they're
Conan's gotten younger. He's making the money. It's fine. I'm sure that they gave it a try. They're scared of him going to ABC, but I'm sorry. You know, let him and Letterman fight over the older people. And Conan can have the young people for the future.
Well, if he does bolt for ABC, as Joe Flint predicts, if he does not get put back into the Tonight Show role, I wonder what will become of Jimmy Kimmel, who does Jimmy Kimmel Live at 11:30 or midnight on ABC.
He goes from midnight to 12:30.
You think so?
Yeah.
And then what happens to Nightline? It just completely
goes away.
Put a gun to its head. Nightline has actually done quite well late night, so it's not a given, I think, that he'll go to ABC. Fox seems more likely to me, but whatever.
Well, Joe Flint's second prediction is that MGM will be sold, and, you know, that's not necessarily new since it's been sold a couple of times. He says it's too easy to say it will be bought by either Time Warner Inc. or News Corp, so we'll venture out on a limb and predict Time Warner. Time Warner, meanwhile, is sitting on a pile of cash. Its CEO, Jeff Bewkes, will probably ease the company out of print business and shut down some Time Inc. publications, or make some of them, such as Entertainment Weekly,
web only.
Another motivating factor, if Time Warner grabs MGM, Warner Brothers gets all the rights to The Hobbit, a potential franchise to succeed Harry Potter. Now, I don't know how that's a franchise, because The Hobbit
that's
was only one book.
That's not a franchise at all. It's two movies and you're out. It's such a stupid comment.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
No, it's not true. They're making two movies and it's over. They're not going to make TV series and miniseries and other feature, you know, we're going to have Legolas the movie. You know, it's ridiculous.
How do you know that they're not going to continue and make a miniseries and maybe
There's no way the estate or they don't have the rights to make 20 movies out of it. There's no way the family would let them. Peter Jackson would have nothing to do with it. They've tentatively thought about, you know, making, you know, a film bridging the two worlds, and they decided against it because they're not going to mess with it. It's like saying, I don't know, you're gonna make Gone with the Wind, and you're gonna do, you know, it's not. They're not going to make four more Lord of the Rings movies.
Well, I'm just devastated at the idea that I'm going to have to start reading Entertainment Weekly on my computer. I mean, I do my fair share of reading on the computer, but I love snuggling into my couch and reading my Entertainment Weekly on Sundays.
Well, who knows what will happen with this rumored Apple tablet. I will say, their stock price now is over $200. That's Apple's stock price. If they don't come out with a tablet, they actually...
I thought it was a done deal that they were going to announce it, what, next week?
I don't know. I don't know when they plan on announcing anything.
But scrolling, it doesn't, you know, they don't go quarter to quarter, Apple. So they don't care if people pump up their stock price on false visions of some new toy that they're going to announce. And if it goes down, it doesn't matter. You know, I think Apple is pretty smart at thinking long term and not worrying about quarter to quarter bumps up and down in the stock price. If it goes down $40 because they don't announce it or it doesn't look as cool as they thought, you know, it's all right. They'll survive long term. It's probably too high as it is right now anyway.
Well, we'll be talking about Apple a little later in the podcast during our Inside Baseball segment. How did we get on Apple?
I don't know, because we're going to talk about that more later. I want to finish off this LA Times article, because I thought it was interesting that he talked about some of the executive shuffles that he figured would go on. And, you know, namely, you know, home video department people having fights with...
The TV people having fights
with... The TV people, yeah. That was so great.
Yeah, he says that the jockeying to succeed Warner Brothers CEO Barry Meyer and President Alan Horn in 2011 will begin. Tom Fresten and Peter Chernin, formerly of Fox, are always rumored to be offered the next CEO gig. They will remain free agents, Joe Flint believes. Fresten, he predicts, will go to Oprah Winfrey's network and possibly even become an executive at Discovery, which owns Oprah Winfrey's network or is partnered with Oprah Winfrey in her network. He will, at the very least, get a board seat. Meanwhile, Peter Chernin will crank out a few movies, a few TV shows at his production company, while he figures out whether he wants to run for political office. That prediction, I thought, was somewhat interesting. Other potential opportunities for Chernin are a deal for MGM, Lionsgate, or Summit Entertainment.
And why does he have all these opportunities? Apparently because he has a penis, like all the other men mentioned in the executive shuffle.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of women who I think were mentioned in here, but because they are home video for Disney or something.
Speaking of Disney, one of the predictions was about Disney buying Electronic Arts Incorporated, the video game company. That actually could happen. That's been rumored for quite some time. It would be a huge sale, and it would also start putting other video game publishers into play. It would, you know, whether it's Rockstar, the group that does the Grand Theft Auto franchise, those would all then become kind of ripe for the picking. I think it would be smart for them to buy Electronic Arts.
Oh, my book would be brilliant.
I mean, maybe not smart for the video game world, but it's smart for Disney. This next prediction, I thought, was a little broad. Washington gets tough with the media industry. Besides forcing some major concessions from Comcast in exchange for approving the NBC deal, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and Congress will start to crack down on long-time cable industry practices. And really what this is referring to is a la carte pricing. Again, we're going to be talking about this toward the end of the show during the Inside Baseball segment.
I thought that was fascinating. That whole section where he talks about how how politics is going to play its part, I thought was really interesting.
Well, for years, Congress has tried to get the cable companies to do a la carte pricing. And this would be where a consumer who has either satellite or cable subscriptions can pick and choose the networks they want. And thus, that might lower the cost for them as a whole. They could say, well, I want Discovery Channel and the Animal Planet and the History Channel, but I really don't want ESPN. The problem with that for sports networks like ESPN or Fox Sports is that while Discovery Channel and the National Geographic Channel get $1 or $1.50 per subscriber, sports networks get $3. They are very lucrative, which is why you see more and more people getting into sports broadcasting.
By the way, if anybody else cares, my food was cold, but I sent it back, and now it's come back nice and warm.
No, you're difficult. Look how difficult you are.
I'm having homemade mac and cheese with some bacon sprinkled on top.
That's so fattening.
So let me get this straight. You're at Cranky Cafe, and
I sent my
getting
food back.
Cranky.
Wonderful.
No, I'm not cranky because they forgot about me and didn't give me my food, and I waited 45 minutes before saying anything, and they've been apologizing profusely, trying to offer me other stuff. I'm like, no, it's quite all right. So I'm a delightful customer.
While you suck up all their free bandwidth.
Yeah, and bother all the people sitting around you.
Yeah, they hate me.
I hate people like you. I loathe people like you.
I never do this, but I got trapped.
You do this every week. What about the week that you were like in a post office box area? You were like in mailboxes, etc. What the hell is that about?
Where in the world is Michael Giltz this week?
I'm with Matt Lauer, but don't tell anybody.
Well, while Washington is getting tough with the media industry, DirecTV will be sold, according to Joe Flint. And this is a prediction for 2010. He says satellite broadcaster DirecTV will be sold to AT&T. The deal will face intense scrutiny. And to get it through Washington, DirecTV will agree to end its exclusive deal with the National Football League. Worried about being left behind, Verizon will start kicking the tires of Dish Network. But Dish CEO Charlie Ergen will lose the deal after attempting to extract too steep a price. Now, I think that this isn't far-fetched, actually. At all.
No, I don't think any of this is far-fetched.
I think that if AT&T gets the Dish Network, there's no reason for them to use satellites because they actually own fiber, but maybe they would. I don't know.
That's a little strange. I'm wondering if they would buy it simply to take that option off the market.
But that would just make DirecTV stronger. I don't think that makes any
sense. It would.
Yeah, they want to have competition for them. And so, you know, that you don't want a cable, fine, they'll give you a satellite. They just want to provide content to you.
I love the way the government's approval of this will hinge upon whether the NFL has an exclusive deal with DirecTV. So obviously there's some politicians out there who are really upset that they can't get the NFL packages, the football packages, on their Comcast or Time Warner cable networks.
Oh, excellent. More. You know, the boys club deciding things for me.
No, I think it's more the fact that they know that's something that their constituents actually care about and will complain and yell at them for if they don't make sure it's okay.
That's probably true. Now, all of this will lead to, this is something that really is close to my heart, as I say every time, Hulu will start charging in 2010, according to Joe Flint.
Yeah, but for what? I don't think he ever specifically said what. Yeah, I mean, I think we all agree that they can and probably should charge for premium content. But yes. At this point, I don't think you can backtrack and say, well, we were giving you full episodes for free and now we're not. I don't think they can do that. I mean, I think that maybe they can say episodes will be free for the first, you know, month.
I mean, obviously, all of this type of new media, new distribution plans are changing with the change of the decade. It was a busy 2009 for these types of business models, or the upending of these types of content distribution business models. And I don't know who, whether it was Karen, you, or Michael, somebody highlighted a story called Thoughts on the Aughts, What Made the Golden Age of TV Glow? And it was a story featured in the Chicago Tribune written by Maureen Ryan. And it's a story basically about the last 10 years of television.
And how it's changed television. Yeah, I posted this. She basically just talks about how things have changed in the past 10 years with television, and she gives examples such as the DVR and how, you know, it's put people in control instead of the networks. And also she talks about how TV is posted online, you know, iTunes and Hulu, just like we were saying, and how that has also changed the way that we watch television. Basically, this is all time shifting and how that's changed the way we watch. It's changed the way television is programmed. But she also talks about, you know, things that are not related to technology, that the focus on antiheroes and the literary, thematically ambitious approaches to television. specifically she mentions The Wire and The Sopranos and Deadwood, which are three shows that I never watched. But I do think she's right. I do think that we are on another golden age of television. And I'm going to pause while Michael says something because I know he's itching to. Michael?
Why did you never watch The Wire, or The Sopranos, or Deadwood?
I knew it. I was like, wow, he really is quiet.
I tried to watch The Wire, and I was painfully bored after about six episodes. The Sopranos, I watched the first episode when it premiered, and I hated it. And I tried to revisit it again, like the next season or two seasons later, and I hated it just as much. And by the time Deadwood was on, what was it, HBO Showtime, I didn't have premium cable. But Noah, Michael, what do you think about this idea that those three shows are the crown jewels of TV's golden age, and that we even are maybe in another golden age of television?
Well, I think when you have, instead of three networks making TV shows, you have 100 channels making TV shows, inevitably you're going to have more quality television. I mean, sitcoms may be thinned out because there are only so many people who can write a sitcom, but when TNT and USA and Sci-Fi and a million other channels are creating programming, you're just going to have more good TV. I think there's a ton of good TV out there, and the explosion of channels and all of them wanting to have a signature show is one good reason. Those three shows are all HBO, obviously. I love two of them. I love The Wire and Deadwood. I'm not a big fan of The Sopranos. But she made a good point about how DVDs for a while helped make shows like that possible. DVDs kept 24 alive after the first season because the sales were so strong. It made a show like that possible. You could do 12 episodes of The Wire because you knew you were going to make X amount of dollars when you sold the shows on DVDs. So DVDs was really a big factor in the noughts, I think, as far as helping, you know, complex shows like those and Lost and Battlestar Galactica, which is also very complex, you know, gain an audience. Because even if you don't have HBO, you could have rented or bought them and kept up on, which is what I do. I never had Showtime, but I'm watching Dexter right now, and it's great.
You know, she talks about, too, about that reality TV is sort of tired of ideas. And while I don't think reality TV is going away, and I don't think she makes that argument, I do think she's absolutely right. There's a difference, and Michael, you actually talk about this quite a bit, that there's a difference between reality television and talent contests on TV. And I think you and I watch talent contests because I can't stand reality TV.
Yeah, I don't watch reality TV show either, really. I don't watch Big Brother or The Hills or Jersey Shore. I'll glance at them. I usually watch them via Talk Soup, where I get like the funniest clip of the week. And of course, it's been around since the beginning of TV. There's been reality shows and game shows and talent shows since the 40s.
Well, Maureen Ryan of the Chicago Tribune, I don't know if she works for them or is just has a guest piece there. She says that cable embraces shows with female leads. And that there's also some great acting out there over the last 10 years.
You know, Linda Obst, also in either the Washington Post or the New York Times piece that I talked about with women in movies, Linda Obst, who was a big producer in the 80s and 90s, she says that one of the reasons why we don't see strong roles for women in movies is because we simply don't have a lot of dramas. So there aren't a lot of really good roles for men or women in movies right now.
That's absolutely true. I will make a distinction between Hollywood movies and movies in general, because there are certainly plenty of independent and foreign films and good smaller Hollywood films that are really good and have, you know, I don't think this is a dead era for movies. It just doesn't happen to be the big Hollywood studio films that are particularly good right now.
Right, I agree. But there are some really, really good roles on cable for women.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's Starbuck on Battlestar Galactica or What's Her Name on The Closer played by Kira Sedgwick, whose character's name I don't know. There's some really, really good roles.
Oh, yeah. Holly Hunter, Kira Sedgwick, Glenn Close. Yeah, if I was a woman over 40, my agent better be talking to cable and TV, because that's where all the good roles are.
Yep.
Well, last week we spoke about Brittany Murphy's untimely death. This week it is one of the big news stories again, because she was buried on Christmas Eve
in a sad. That's awful.
Yeah, well, that's really what most of the news is about. We shouldn't really go too much into this because it's really a private matter for the family. The family, Simon Monjak, her husband, has been giving interviews to anybody with a pulse, it seems.
Michael and I both really didn't want to talk about this because it was so gossipy, but you know, I have to admit that I've been aware of who her husband was for a while, and it's sort of delicious to really gossip about the fact that he was supposedly a con artist, and, you know, he wasn't liked on the movie sets that she was on when he went to go visit her. But it really, to me, is just sort of sad that this is what we're talking about. And I think part of the reason is because it's the holidays and there's not a lot of real news going on, but we are completely obsessed with death. And scandal. Look at Tiger. Wow, Brittany Murphy dying is probably one of the better things that happened to him.
And by Tiger, you mean Tiger Woods.
Oh, God, don't.
Yes,
don't do that.
For those of us who are listening in space.
I wasn't going to go into, he's a golfer. Early in the week, I think it was in EW or I don't know which media outlet I read this in, but Simon Monjak, Brittany Murphy's husband, gave an interview saying that he was devastated, that he hoped Brittany Murphy's mother would continue living with them or him because that's his tie to Brittany.
And I please hope she didn't, take me out of the will.
And she did.
She did?
Yes.
See, I don't even know this story.
Brittany Murphy left her entire estate to her mother. And he was very heartfelt in some of the statements he made to the press that the reason he didn't want an autopsy is just he couldn't bear the thought of having anybody cut up Brittany Murphy.
Oh, and to find the wife. Cocaine that was in her body.
Well, I don't know about that. But then toward the end of the week, there were stories like the one from the New York Daily News, your stomping ground, Michael. Brittany Murphy was warned about husband Simon Monjak, but did not listen. And apparently Monjak retorted to the Daily Mail in London, "My problem is that I do not look like Ashton Kutcher."
Her ex-boyfriend. What? This is so gossipy, Sperling. Why are we talking about this?
Right. Really, what we should be talking about is the fact that, really, it's gotten to a point where because the aughts, as they're called, are the decade of the celebrity, according to some people, not all, it's gotten to a point where...
Because, we had no celebrities in the 90s or 80s.
No, but I see where he's going with this. It's going to be the decade of the celebrity because there are so many more outlets for people to become famous.
Well, there's that, but really, it's sad that the Los Angeles Police Department and the coroner, they can't keep their leaks shut. They can't, they perform this autopsy and just hours later, the initial results are being released to the press with all of the drugs that were in her system, including some antidepressants, including some painkillers. It's pretty depressing that this can happen.
Well, it's the year of the celebrity. I guess you're taking it that way. The decade of the celebrity for two reasons. And yeah, one is because people will do anything for money and you can't keep anything secret. All you have to do is just, find out what their price is, pay it. And celebrities will always, always be news. No matter what kind of scoop you have on somebody, someone wants it. But then there's also the fact that there are so many different ways to become famous. And we have raised a group of kids they're teenagers and in their early 20s now, who that's all they want
is to become famous. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so easy to become famous.
It was just like that in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And, women wanted to be flappers and, girlfriends of gangsters so they could be famous just for being who they were, just a showgirl.
That sense of human nature will always be around. But it's just that now we have more ways to become famous. The internet has helped us do that.
Well, another sad story this week is singer-songwriter Vic Chestnut passed away. There's some rumors that it was potentially a suicide, an overdose of muscle relaxants.
Who is this guy?
He is a singer-songwriter, and I think Michael put it best in our prep. Did you want to say what you said during prep, Michael?
Well, he's got some big fans. He's from the from the REM world, and he's got a lot of fans in the music industry. But he's certainly better known among industry people than the outside world. And if anybody knows him, it's because he's got physical problems and had multiple suicide attempts and has had a depressed, messed up life and was in a car accident, I believe, and that sort of left him partially paralyzed. So he's got a lot of backstory.
Himself?
And he's had documentary film made about him, and he's recorded about a dozen albums. I think he's modestly talented, but he has big-name friends, and his life story is so dramatic. I think that's why people still know and talk about him.
Well, one of those big-name friends is Michael Stipe, who discovered Vic Chestnut in Athens, Georgia, where he's from. He discovered him in the mid-80s. In 1983, Vic Chestnut was in a single-car drunk driving accident, which left him a paraplegic in a wheelchair.
Oh, God.
So, and I guess what struck me was reading one of the obituaries in the LA Times. He was just in Los Angeles playing a couple of shows, and the interview he did with the LA Times reporter, he was talking about the fact that he couldn't afford his insurance anymore, and his health insurance, and that his health insurance had stopped paying for some of his needs. and he didn't know how he was going to pay for any of it. And he mentioned that he was making installment payments, but he couldn't even afford that anymore. And he just was beside himself. He didn't know what to do. Obviously, he is somebody that battled a lot of demons. He openly struggled with depression and anxiety and alcoholism, and definitely acknowledged drug use. I believe one of his albums is called Drunk. But despite all of that, as Michael said, he maintained a prolific career. He released at least 12 albums. And
how did he die?
Well, he was surrounded by family and friends and died in Athens, Georgia, on the afternoon of Friday, the 25th of December.
But he almost certainly committed suicide.
Yeah, he was in a coma for a little while. A friend of his on Twitter said, another singer-songwriter, Kristen Hirsch, said on Twitter on Thursday, "I can tell you what I know, but no one knows much. Another suicide attempt looks bad. Coma. If he survives, there may be brain damage." And that was via Twitter from one of his friends. So it looks like an overdose of muscle relaxants. So if you get a chance, you should definitely check out some of his music. We'll post a link to an NPR story, which links to some performances and some music by him. Another musician, or personality from the music world, I should say, who is in a little bit of trouble these days, is rapper Lil Wayne, who once again escapes drug charges, this time crossing the Texas border from Mexico. Apparently, his tour bus was stopped by Border Patrol when a few drug-sniffing dogs discovered some marijuana. And along with other 11 other people, he was detained.
Have we moved on to Big Deal, Big Whoop? Because I'm about Big Whoop.
Well, you know, it would have been really big if...
That's where it belongs.
Yeah, well, as everyone knows, he pled guilty in October to attempted criminal possession of a weapon.
I didn't know.
You didn't know? We covered it right here on Showbiz Sandbox.
Wow, we're not even listening when we're talking.
Exactly. That's because he's too busy, like, hanging out in at Cafe Cranky or Cranky Cafe. What is more interesting to me is, oh, by the way, that sentencing for that gun possession, it's going to be in February, and it looks like he's going to spend a year in jail. More interesting is that Lil Wayne's delayed album was released early by Amazon. I guess this is an album that's been pushed back about 6 times, and it was pushed back from a December 21st release date this time to something like February 1st. And Amazon had already been given the album, so they shipped it out to some of the people who had pre-ordered it. And 500 copies made it out into the wild, so to speak, and some people started reviewing it.
And in the rap world, where they're so hyper, they don't even like to give copies to critics before the album hits the stores. I mean, they have listening parties, and they make you wait until it's out in the stores before they send it to you a lot of the times. Even big critics from big papers. So this is really a big screw-up.
Why is that, Michael?
Because they don't want other people to steal their loops. It's a very hyper-competitive world where you're always releasing mixtapes, and you want to be able to surprise people. So they really hold it close to the grip. They don't trust anybody.
So rap artists are worried about people stealing the loops on their albums, which they themselves stole.
They don't steal. They pay for it. They don't steal it. It's a creative achievement, and every single one of them is licensed and paid for. And they're not just worried about that. They're worried about people stealing the album as a whole, people named Sperling, who think everything should be free.
Wait a second. Wait a second. I never said everything should be free, and I don't steal.
But they are worried that if leaks out, it will get posted online, and then people, you know, there's a big problem. You know, there's a big problem with, you know, bootlegs and all that sort of stuff, and you just don't want to deal with that. And so they're really, really careful in that world.
We're always going on and on about alternative distribution methods and alternative ways for whether it's a TV show or a band or an artist to pay for the creation of their work and then distribute it. Well, a band called Shearwater is releasing a new album called The Golden Archipelago, and it is due out from Matador Records on February 23rd, but they'd like to put it out with this 75-page book of full-color photos, and I've seen some of them. They're actually quite interesting. The problem is, of course, printing a 75-page book of full-color photos costs a fortune, and Matador Records is saying, we're a record company, not a book publishing company, so we're not going to do that. However, the band came up with an interesting idea. They went to Kickstarter.com, and we'll place a link to this in the show notes, and they are going to their fans to raise the $6,000 needed to pay for the limited edition companion to the album. And Shearwater has until January 31st to reach its goal. I think they've raised something like $4,900 already. If they don't reach their goal, they get no money. If they reach their goal, they get all the money that's donated to them. And of course, if you donate money, you get prizes or you get certain gifts from the band. If you go to Kickstarter.com, there are tons of bands doing this. And actually, it's paying for a lot of content creation. It's an interesting way to pay for it.
Yeah, they say you're a fan, and instead of waiting until the album comes out, help us fund making the album. You know, send us $20 and we'll make the album, give you a copy when it's done, you know, and we'll sign it and give you something special. So it's a really interesting trend.
I know Jill Sobule did the same thing. I don't think she used Kickstarter, but she had her fans, I think 20,000 fans contributed, pay for her most recent album. It's not a bad idea.
It's a great idea. Yeah. I should get people to pay me to write.
Don't you normally call those people editors?
Yeah, but they're all dead now.
I'm sure your current editors are would appreciate hearing that. As we just mentioned, everybody wants, and by everybody, I mean Karen and Michael, would like us to move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular segment in which we discuss the entertainment news of the week and decide whether it's a big deal or whether anybody should care about it. Well, our first story this week is about Jackass, and we're not talking about any one of our hosts. We're talking about Johnny Knoxville's long-running MTV show.
Big whoop, I can always say it right now. Sorry, go on.
Well, the third installment of the film franchise, he turned the TV show into a film, is going to be in 3D, apparently, and it's set to arrive October 15th, 2010. Jeff Tremaine is back to direct with Spike Jonze and Johnny Knoxville on board to produce. The first two movies made $164 million, and they probably cost all of about $1.50 to make. So these are very profitable films. Johnny Knoxville, who was kind of the front man for this Jackass craze, he says they're going to take this, and this is a quote, take the same 3D technology James Cameron used in Avatar and stick it up Steve-O's butt. We're taking stupid to a whole new dimension.
Ugh, I can't stand him.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop? Michael, we know what Karen thinks.
It's totally a big deal. I've seen both of the first two movies. Can't wait to see the third. And forget Avatar. This is what 3D was born to be used for.
Well, I'm sure at CES we're going to be hearing a lot about 3D televisions. There's going to be one 3D television offering after another.
What happened to what we were talking about earlier and the fact that it's more about content and not about the screen? I still believe that.
Well, the screen manufacturers are trying to turn it back into it's more about the screen than the content.
And everyone who just spent $1,500 like me on their widescreen TV is not going to upgrade to 3D, trust me. Plus, there's nothing you want to watch. You watch tons of TV a night. You're not going to watch sports for 3 or 4 hours with 3D glasses on. It's crazy.
Well, I can tell you that there's nothing that can kill 3D faster than bad 3D. And this is the kind of content that would definitely kill it for 3D aficionados. Our next story is about Charlie Sheen, who was arrested after a domestic violence abuse was filed against
him. That surprised me.
Apparently, he pulled a knife on his wife.
I keep interrupting you. Yeah, apparently he pulled a knife on her, but she was drunk.
Yeah, so maybe he was trying to protect himself.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that it happened because he's got a terrible reputation and, you know, his background kind of, you know, makes it so it's not such a huge surprise, especially around the holidays when domestic violence, you know, rises. But I tell you, I was watching the news with my mom and we were, you know, watching all about the flight, you know, the terrorist attack. And then it's like, and coming up next, you know, Charlie Sheen arrested for domestic violence. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah. Well, apparently it was on Christmas Day, Friday morning, after emergency call from a house in the ski resort of Aspen, Colorado. That's where the call was made from. And he spent a couple of hours in jail. He was released on $8,500 bail. He married Brooke Mueller in May of 2008. Now, is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's always a big deal when the star of the biggest sitcom on TV gets arrested. So, yeah, it's a big deal.
It's a big deal for so many reasons, yeah.
Okay, well, he has been arrested before in 1996 for assaulting a woman who claimed she had been knocked unconscious at his home.
Who else has been arrested? Have you been arrested, Sperling? And what about you, Karen?
I've been arrested.
You have?
I've been arrested.
Whoa. For what?
Karen, have you ever been in prison or have you ever been in jail?
I was in jail.
I've been in jail too.
Now, before, you know, people start, you know, thinking any less of us. I was arrested when I was 19 years old for having a fake ID by Officer Palmer in Boulder, Colorado. And it was the second time Officer Palmer had caught me. And I had a better fake ID this time, which meant that I was caught impersonating somebody else, which is a felony. And I was arrested and cuffed and put in the paddy wagon and taken to jail where I spent the night. And my brother came and got me the next morning. You know, I did community service and it was expunged. But yeah, anybody out there looking for my mugshot, I'm sure it exists. So, Michael, why were you arrested?
I was arrested for delivering a pizza late for Domino's.
Are you serious?
It's an incredibly long story, but I'd been pulled over before for an expired tag. It was my brother's car, and he said, "Oh, I'll pay it," and he never paid it. And so eventually, after sending two or three notices, they put a warrant out for your arrest. So when I got pulled over for speeding, there was a warrant out for my arrest, and I didn't know why. So they cuffed me and dragged me off to jail, and then my brother bailed me out the next morning. It was basically a Saturday night, a bunch of drunks. And the main cell was being cleaned out. So there were about 12 drunks in a cell designed for about two people. And I walk into this room, into this cell. There's guys on the bed, guys on the floor, guys leaning against the wall. And I'm wearing my Domino's shirt, my Domino's, you know, got everything on Domino's. And
oh, I walk no. In and make you wear the outfit? I had to wear the outfit.
Yeah, and one drunk. No, I didn't get processed.
Oh,
that
I had
much.
To wear the outfit.
And so I walk into the room, and one drunk looks up from the other side of the room and says, What'd they arrest you for? Delivering a cold pizza? And they all burst out laughing.
Well, at least you had an icebreaker.
That's awesome.
Our next story is one we probably shouldn't cover because it really
is
none of our business.
It's gossipy and very sad.
Yes, it's gossipy, very sad. Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins, who have been a couple for 23 years, have separated. Susan Sarandon is 63, Robbins is 51. They've been, of course, a noteworthy acting couple, known a lot for their political activism. They met on the set of Bull Durham. They have two sons together, Jack, who is 20, and Miles, who is 17. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for them, but it's also kind of a big deal for people who really liked seeing them together. My mom was devastated. Oh, no, they've been married for 23 years or whatever. I'm like, actually, Mom, they weren't married. And all of a sudden the story kind of changed a little bit. But it's very sad.
Michael?
I have to say I had the same reaction as Karen's mom. I saw that on the TV and I went, aw, which is like kind of silly. You know, you have such an identification with these people. I mean, we don't know them. I mean, I've interviewed her. I've never interviewed him. But we don't know them. I have no idea what their life is like or why I would have any investment in their marriage. But I was a little surprised and I was like, oh, that's too bad.
They're both very nice people. And I've interviewed both of them and very, very nice, both of them. Our next story is about Tyra Banks, who, like Oprah Winfrey, is saying goodbye to
her... What? This is news to me!
Yeah, it's hot off the presses. She's saying goodbye to her talk show after five seasons and two daytime Emmy Awards. She is going to call it quits in the spring of 2010. She says, this will be the last season of The Tyra Show. She told People exclusively this information. I've been loving having fun, which is so grammatically incorrect, I won't even touch it. Coming into your living rooms, bedrooms, hair salons for the past 5 years. Wait, living rooms, bedrooms, and hair salons. What is wrong with that picture?
No, that's where TVs are, absolutely.
All
hair
right.
Salons, it's a big gathering place. You're just not a sister.
I'm not a sister, no. Being a man. Well, big deal or big whoop, Karen?
A big deal.
Michael?
Big whoop. Who cares?
How can you say that?
I never watched it.
Well, here's what I think is especially interesting, is that she, when she was on the air, always kind of positioned herself to be the next Oprah, or at least her people did. Somebody was, because that's always – she was written about that a lot as the potential next Oprah. So I'm wondering if it's a coincidence that when Oprah steps down, so does Tyra. Does she think that by not having a show, she can step into Oprah's? Please, because it seems to me that quite the opposite would be true.
Yeah, the opposite would be true. This is a clear indication that she's run her course and knows she's not going to be able to move up and take over. You know, Ellen is clearly the one who's going to capitalize. If she wanted to capitalize, she would stay on the show and try to get better
time. I don't know if Ellen will. They're very different.
Well, I do know that somebody close to her, a source, unnamed and anonymous, said that it was Oprah stepping down that gave her the courage to step down herself.
And you know what? She's awful. She's really just an awful host.
Yeah.
Well, she plans on, Karen, you'll like this, she plans on going off to become a film producer and make projects that appeal to young girls and women.
You know, she'd probably be very good at that.
She is successful at everything she tries her hand at, so I would not count her out. Moving on, Wicked star Idina Menzel, and also former college classmate of Sperling.
Really?
Yes, she was lived down the hall from me my freshman year in Weinstein Dormitory at NYU. She was right down the hall, like 2-3 doors down. And then, of course, she went on to do a little musical called Rent with my friend Anthony Rapp. She is not going to come to Glee, however, at least not yet. The show's creator and Ryan Murphy told People that she doesn't know what he's doing. He does not know what he's doing with Idina yet. I just met with her once. It sort of got leaked out, but I haven't plotted it out yet. Kristen Chenoweth, who also starred in Wicked as Glinda the Good Witch, will come back to Glee. She played former McKinley High Glee Club star April Rhodes, and she did a really good job of that, I have to say. She's going to come back in the spring. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
Well, it's disappointing, but ultimately it's not a very... It's big whoop.
Michael?
I'd say it's a big whoop, too. I mean, I like the show. It's one of my favorites of the year, even though it's inconsistent. I like both those actors. I've interviewed Idina Menzel. If I'd known she was your college classmate, why, I would have known. But I hadn't met you yet, so... But it's, you know, she'll be on the show eventually, so it's definitely a big whoop, because it's not like he said she'll never be on the show. It's just not happening yet.
Indeed. Well, that brings us to our final segment, Inside Baseball, in which we discuss some of the news stories of the week that maybe only people in Hollywood might care about. So this week, we have something that is sure to be of interest to many people. It is a proposal from Apple to offer online TV subscriptions. So we said we'd talk a little bit more about Apple and a little bit more about TV online. Well, here it is. Apple is eliciting tentative interest, according to the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. They're eliciting tentative interest from some networks in its proposal to offer a TV subscription package via the internet. This would allow consumers such as myself, Karen and Michael, and everybody else out there to ditch their cable, ditch their satellite subscriptions, and go online only. It would also allow them to do a la carte purchasing of television, meaning you don't have to get 500 channels when all you want to watch is 30, and you pay for those 30. AllThingsD.com reported last month that Apple was proposing a $30 a month supplement to its iTunes service to the networks. I don't know how that would work because they'd have to pay, they'd pay like a dollar per network, so I don't know how that would work. Certainly, this is all speculation. The talks are somewhat in the early stages, according to the New York Times. ABC and CBS are among the networks that are considering joining the Apple venture. People close to the talks said this past Monday. Interesting stuff.
Does this mean that I would have to watch TV on my computer?
No, you could probably watch it on this proposed tablet that Apple has.
That's the same idea. It's watching it. That's like watching TV on a Kindle.
Yeah, but I'm sure that you could hook your computer up or your Apple TV up to...
That's assuming I know how to do that.
Right.
Yeah, that's a total pain in the neck to do.
It's becoming less and less so, but yes, right now it's kind of not convenient, that's for
Virtually
sure.
Virtually no one does it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
less than
1%
of the people do it.
I couldn't even set up my TiVo. I think this is really interesting because I do think that this is probably the way that TV is going to go, and I think this is a step in that direction.
I agree.
But I just don't think people are at that. We're not. It's only early adopters that are watching a lot of TV on their computers. Well, not. It's early adopters and other people who have realized how great it is and don't mind doing it.
But what's the advantage? Is it supposed to be cheaper, or what's the whole point here? I mean, because I like some cable companies are trying to make it more mobile. So they're saying, look, if you subscribe to our cable company and you've got cable coming to your home, we're going to make it so you can watch it online on your laptop wherever you go and watch it on your phone. We're going to make it free and easy and invisible and really easy for you to do. And that makes sense to me. They're adding value to what they already do. But I have no interest in stopping watching my TV and only watching my computer.
I think that's what this is saying, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is an alternative.
And Michael, what you're referring to is Fancast, which is offered by Comcast.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I you know, that makes sense to me, but this is like, so I don't, like $1,500, you know, you want me to buy a 3D TV and you want me to buy a $1,500 widescreen TV, but you also want me to ditch my cable and just watch it on my laptop? I don't think so.
Michael, the economy is hurting. We need people like you to help bolster the economy.
TV will never be passe. But I think that we're reaching a generational shift where the ability to watch TV on your computer is going to be cooler than having a gigantic screen.
Yeah, I just don't see what the game changer is about this Apple offering other than a la carte. I mean, I like competition for the cable companies because my cable bill's too high. But other than that, it doesn't get me excited. And I love almost everything Apple does.
But that to me, though, Michael, is enough of a game changer. Because they say that they have to get the networks involved. And as soon as you get the networks to wrap their brain around the concept of a la carte for this, then that's the beginning.
No, you are right. I think a la carte's important. But I think it'll be less exciting for people than they think. I think, it'll just lower the price for the bulk packaging. It's not that people won't get it. It's just once they offer a la carte, it'll force them to lower that $90 cable bill down to $60 or $70. And once it's a little more reasonable, most people I don't think are going to want to bother to pick and choose, because suddenly you'll find out, oh, no, there's a show on the Learning Channel my mother told me about. I don't have it. That's going to get very annoying very quick. Just having those channels there so when I want to watch something on Versus or the Learning Channel or somebody tells me about some show that I've never heard of, I want to be able to get that channel. And it seems like a more of a pain when you limit yourselves to the 14 you think you want.
I know what you mean. You don't know the channels that you are going to want.
Well, we should limit ourselves and bring this podcast to a close so that it doesn't get too long. We hope you had a happy holiday. If you would like links to any of the stories we discussed on today's podcast, you can find them in our show notes. Just visit showbizsandbox.com and you can look up the show notes for episode 35. Of course, you can always subscribe to this podcast in iTunes, and please feel free to give it a rating.
A high rating.
Well, you can give it any rating you want. 5 stars. You can also send us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave a voicemail for us as well. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular rock group MGMT. They can be found at myspace.com/MGMT or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found at michaelgiltz.com, where links to all of his writing are posted. He can also be found on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. And let's see if I remembered Karen Woodward's Twitter username from last week. It's @Karen_Woodward on Twitter.
That's right.
Can't believe I remembered it. You can also find links to her writing on the website KarenWoodwardOnline.com. Links to my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. I'm also on Twitter. Look up the name @Sperling. Now, Michael, do me a favor and don't forget to tip your waitress.
Yeah.
I already have a generous $3 tip on a $10 tab, $8 tab.
Well, can the band that you have there play us out?
Absolutely. They're not as good as MGMT, but they'll do their best.
All righty. Until next week, play nice.